Okay, as usual, we'll be looking at several slides here for just a moment. So find your place in Isaiah 52, and then we'll be, as I say, looking at this and then going back to the text itself. I might just mention that throughout the 20th century, I think it was born somewhere in the 20th century, there came to be a kind of a standard illustration of the prophets that was the mountain peaks of prophecy. Have you ever heard about the mountaintops of prophecy? Okay. And the idea was used very inappropriately, and in some cases perhaps even deceitfully, by premillennialists to try and explain away holes and problems and contradictions that they had in their doctrine. And so they would say, well, the prophets from their viewpoint can only see these mountain peaks, and then they would use certain prophecies, you know, to support their thing, and then in the holes would be the stuff they couldn't defend. You know, so it kind of fell out of favor a little bit. I'm not surprised most of you have maybe not heard of this mountain peaks prophecy thing. But tonight, let me use it. When you're studying the book of Isaiah, you got 66 chapters. We've already innumerable times said, you know, divide well into two parts, and that you have a certain kind of information, mostly Old Testament oriented, in the first 39 chapters, and then the last 27 look more to the future, more to the Christ. But if just within Isaiah's 66 chapters, you were to think of it as having a mountain range and having a series of very prominent peaks, certainly tonight is one of those peaks. You all know Isaiah 53. You know what it's talking about. You understand it very, very thoroughly, I have no doubt. It is one of, if not the tallest mountain in all of Isaiah. It's just magnificent. It is beautiful. And yet, it's kind of odd in a way that at the same time that it is this glorious mountain peak that we all so appreciate and depend upon, you know, it is only that because of the terrible depth of the dark valley of the shadow of death, you know, it lies at the foot of that mountain. And so it is simultaneously Isaiah 53, something that brings us great hope and we appreciate, and yet we recognize it's about the death of Jesus the Christ, and it's very graphically that. So we'll take that up in just a minute, this wondrous prophecy. But as you'll recall, we have now entered into those last chapters, 40 through 66. We've studied the first nine, 40 through 48. God sets himself before, very, you know, pugnaciously almost, the whole world, and especially the idolatrous world, demanding that if they think they've got anything to offer, then stand up and show it. But because God is able to foretell the future, he over and over and over and over and over and over again in those nine chapters says that he not only speaks, which these idols can't do, but he carries the burdens of his people rather than being a burden for cattle to bear like idols are. And he can foretell the future. So this foretelling of the future, this ability to prophesy, you know, is so prominent, like a mountain peak, in chapters 40 through 49. Then you come to 49 through 56. And as we've pointed out over the course of the last couple of weeks, there is a servant who is suffering horribly and has come to be known as the suffering servant passages or the suffering servant section. So you've seen this slide before. This term, my servant, or some variation thereof, appears first in Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 4, and then in chapter 49, verse 3, verse 5, verse 6, and verse 7, then in chapter 50 and verse 10, all passages which we've already considered. But tonight, in just a moment, we'll be looking at chapter 52 and verse 13, and then finally at chapter 53 and verse 11. So I'm hoping to get through all of 53, maybe a little bit farther tonight. But what that means is that we are coming to the end of the actual verses that mention that servant. So we've had other servants, as you know. Cyrus was identified as a servant. He is certainly not this servant. But in those passages, this servant is Jesus the Christ. And this servant is not just a suffering servant, but the one who will pay the highest conceivable price in that on our behalf. So if you'll just have a look now at the screen, or if you prefer, you can look into your Bibles. I suggested last week, and want to emphasize again as we begin tonight, this 53rd chapter really should have started at chapter 52, verse 13. The last three verses of chapter 52 clearly are not so well attached to what has gone before in chapter 52, and they are intimately associated. Clearly, they're a direct part of what follows in chapter 53. So it's unfortunate they just missed the chapter break there, but we very purposely ended with chapter 52, verse 12 last week. The last three verses say in chapter 52, "Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him, for what had not been told them they will see, and what they had not heard they will understand." So here is that term, "my servant," again. And here is exaltation and prosperity and lifted up and greatly exalted. So as we begin this section, it's all good stuff. It has to do with an individual who is held in the highest esteem, who is receiving the gratitude, the thanksgiving, the honor, the glory that he deserves. It's high that he's lifted up. He's not just exalted. He's greatly exalted. But then immediately, we start down into that valley as well. So if you have a New American Standard, a couple of words have been added. In verse 14 says, "Just as many were astonished at you," then in italics, "my people," so his appearance was marred more than any man. Well, on the slide, I left the italicized words out. They're not in the original Hebrew text. And I think, if you think about it a minute, it still is referring to Jesus. It doesn't have to be a comparison between Jesus and something else. It is about Jesus. So people were astonished at how badly he was marred. His appearance was marred, and that's what's astonishing. More than any man. His form, more than the sons of men. So more than any man. And thus, it is on account of this marring. It is because of his appearance being so astonishingly marred that he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what had not been told them, they will see. What they had not heard, they will understand. Agrippa comes to mind. Yes, he's listening to Paul, for instance. We get later into our book of Acts. The other kings, Paul's going to stand before Nero, the emperor himself, and be acquitted the first time. Before a second time, he'll be put to death. It had been prophesied not only here, but in other places that the apostles were going to represent Christ, to the lowest of the low on earth, but also to the highest of the high. And in point of fact, the gospel would just shut the mouths of whoever heard it. Last night at the Cafe Yum, as we were going through Luke chapter 5, we saw this very thing, how amazing it was that the Pharisees' hearts could be so hard that they would not accept the miracles. And we talked about that a little bit. But nonetheless, the point of what we were looking at last night is how terribly frustrating it had to be for them. You cannot gainsay Jesus Christ. When they hit him, on the night that he was captured and about to be killed the next day, why do you strike me? Is there any charge that could be laid against him? And there's not. They knew there was no sin they could charge him with. It was lie upon lie upon lie. And so this individual's very body will be mutilated, marred, and astonishingly so. But his words and his gospel is unconquerable. It has always been. You can only just shut your mouth when you see it and understand it. Those who speak against it, they don't understand it because it's just foolish. Or they have something to lose. They are corrupt. Their hearts are hardened. But when you understand it, and you have any kind of ray of honesty in there, You just have to accept it because it can't be answered. It can't be proven wrong. It cannot be defeated. So we're standing on this mountaintop. We have this highly exalted one who will prosper because of these things, but he's got to suffer this abominable, you know, terrible trauma upon his form in order that he might do this. Now, tonight, I'm going to spend a lot of time on that word sprinkle. I am trusting in your understanding of Isaiah 53. So we're going to read the whole chapter tonight. We'll at least finish, you know, the chapter itself. But right at the outset, and before we even get to chapter 53, this word sprinkle has been set before us. And it is a sprinkling of many nations. So automatically, instantaneously, and unarguably, what's being sprinkled? In a single word that starts with a G and ends with isles. The Gentiles. See, it's Gentiles. Now this must have been, brethren, just the most head-scratching kind of a thought. Because when you say sprinkle to a Jew, and we're in Isaiah, that's the only people he's talking to at the time, they know what that means, and we're going to study it in detail. And the idea that that would ever happen to a Gentile is just unthinkable. Yes, it's sprinkled tonight. I think in most translations it's sprinkled, and we'll see why in a little bit. So, he will sprinkle these many nations, and kings of many nations, not just the Jews, you know, are going to shut their mouths on account of this. So, since ordinarily on the Lord's Supper, when you come, you know, to this passage, whoever's doing the reading, and I must have heard it read several hundred times in the last four decades, as you have as well, it almost never happens, but I have seen it happen here, that these first three verses will be read. They'll start the reading, and we'll talk about it at the Lord's Supper with Isaiah 53:1. But this concept, and these concepts as a bundle in the last three verses of chapter 52, are the foundation for what follows in chapter 53. So, here's a couple of those fun facts, I call them, with regard to this idea of sprinkling. This, some form of the word, sprinkle, sprinkled, is used 57 times in the Bible, in both the Old and New Testaments together. It's in 54 verses, but it's used a total of 57 times. And there are only three of the 57 times some form of that word is used that do not involve, directly address, or dealing with, talking about, elaborating upon, cleansing. The majority of them are, the great majority are in the Old Testament, and they have to do with a variety of functions of the Levitical priesthood. So when the sprinkling is taking place, there's a cleansing that's taking place. Instantly then, the very prominent and almost exclusive thought that any Jew attaches to this word is that of cleansing. Now, all but 12 of the 57 times this word is used will have either in the same verse, usually in the same verse, a couple of exceptions, it's in the adjoining verse, but it's also talking about blood. It's not just sprinkling, but more than 80% of the time, it's also talking about a sprinkling of blood. So when a Jew hears about sprinkling, first they think cleansing, that's the rare exception that it's not, and then they think blood. It's the blood of cleansing. Now these other times, in the midst of these 12, there is a sprinkling of oil, but it has to do with cleansing. There are sprinklings of water, but it has to do with cleansing. There's a sprinkling of myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. It has nothing to do with sprinkling. It's the evil woman, the adulterous woman, in Proverbs 7, sprinkling her bed as an enticement to adultery. So that one, you know, it's got nothing to do with cleansing. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Then you've got a sprinkling of gray hair.
And the gray hair, of course, hasn't got anything to do with cleansing. In that particular passage, it's just dealing with someone who is older. You have sprinkling of ashes, that's your red heifer. And again, that has to do with atonement for sin. And then there's three times, I think, where it uses the word, but it doesn't specify what, you know, the sprinkling is. And this is one of those. He'll sprinkle many nations. Sprinkle them with what? Sprinkle them for what purpose? Well, it's not specified. And that's what led me on this particular study, you know, for tonight's class. Is that this is one of those only three times where the word is used, and the thing that is being sprinkled and the purpose for the sprinkling is not stated in the verse. Now, by the time we get through chapter 53, there isn't any doubt about it. But nonetheless, you know, it kind of piqued my interest, and I've been wanting to do this for years anyway, so I went ahead for this class. I would now like to take quite a bit of time, but I would like to, for you to see every occurrence of this word in the New Testament, because it only appears in two books in the New Testament. But when it appears in the New Testament, it's very dramatic. And it is, I think, like a mountaintop, if you will. By the time you get into that Hebrew letter, where all but one of these is going to appear, you've got a book that is dealing with Jesus the cross. But it's what we call the better letter. It's about how in every aspect, he and what he does and accomplishes is superior to the Old Testament. And when you get into chapter 9 and you're dealing with sprinkling in the Hebrew letter, the way that it's developed, you know, suddenly I think you really appreciate, oh, I get why it appears so much in the Old Testament. I see this grand fulfillment. Here the New Testament is drawing this grand conclusion for us. We get this big vista from the top of the mountain. But if you don't see the significance of the word, didn't grow up a Jew in the Old Testament killing goats, you know, and it can kind of sail over our heads. So let's go ahead and look at these. They're in Hebrews chapter 9, chapter 10, and chapter 12. There's quite a few verses involved, so we are going to spend some time there. Mark, you know, put a string ribbon there at Isaiah. We'll be back after a bit. But we want to read every one of these verses in Hebrews tonight. And we'll carry them back with us as we go into Isaiah here in just a few moments. So we're going to start in Hebrews chapter 9, and we're going to look at verses 11 through 22. Now, that's a big long section, but you'll see why in just a minute. So starting in 9:11, we have a paragraph beginning of a new thought. When Christ appeared as a high priest, well, most of these associations with sprinkling and blood and water and oil have to do with priestly functions from the Old Testament. When Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling, there it is, those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offer himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid when men are dead, for it is never in force
while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with blood. And according to the law, almost all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Now, there's only about a dozen times when I, am really just fed up with the New American Standard. I still think it's the best translation you can buy, though the New King James is a mighty close second. I love the New American Standard. But if you're looking at the New American Standard, the italicized words, "one may," and then "any," after the word "almost," so three words before and after that word "almost," they completely, derange your understanding. They're unhelpful. They're misleading. It's not intentional. They think they're helping, but they really mess things up. Because what the verse says is, according to the law, almost all things are cleansed with blood. Can anybody tell me, are you smarter than a fifth grade Bible student? What is not cleansed with blood in the Old Testament? Clay pots. Now, if you sprinkle blood on clay, would you be able to wash it off very readily? No. So in that case, this ceremonial cleansing would not be able to be washed away so that the vessel could safely be used. You would be running a risk now of disease and pollution. So it's not "one may almost say." That's a terrible translation. It just is, according to the law, almost all things are cleansed with blood. Clay pots weren't. But the point is, you need blood if you're going to cleanse what? Anything that's going to be used in the service of God, save for the clay pots, because in that case, you'd have a problem. So this lengthy passage, though, 11 through 22, it's mentioning sprinkling several times. It's making blood very, very prominent. And in this one passage, it is collecting all the Old Testament sacrifices. You see calves and goats and priests, and you have this far view, of the law and all that it did. But could it cleanse a conscience? No. Could the blood of Jesus Christ cleanse a conscience? Yes. What the law could not do, this sprinkling of Christ's blood can do. Okay? So it's the better letter. And here in this passage, you see all the sprinkling verses of the Old Testament just being summed up and set before you. Fulfillment, triumph, success, substance. We had shadow. We had typology before. Now, we have the reality. We have Jesus the Christ. We have His blood. We have the cleansing not of bodies, not, of things, but of consciences. We have perfect, pure, and complete cleansing. Now, you can see the next passage is in chapter 10. So the theme really is continuing. In chapter 10, it's just two adjoining verses, 21 and 22. Since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with what? Pure water. Now, undeniably, there's your baptism. And in the course of this baptizing of your body, where water is a symbol of cleansing, you have your body going down into the water. But what is really being washed? What's being sprinkled? Your conscience, your heart, your mind. The sense of guilt is utterly removed. The freedom from the bondages of sin, you know, completely. Because as you know so well, again from chapter 9, can the blood of bulls and goats take away sin?
No.
But it had to be offered all those 15 centuries so that we would come to appreciate the value of Christ's blood. So now in verses 21 and 22, for a second time, we have internal cleansing, we have heart cleansing, we have mind cleansing, we have conscience cleansing, we have actual cleansing, full cleansing, permanent cleansing, which the blood of so many animals sprinkled in the past could never do. And then your last passage there is chapter 12. So in chapter 12, we'll look at verses 22, 23, and 24. 12:22. You have come to Mount Zion. Now, you'll note verses 18 and down through 21 are comparing Old Testament with New. I need to get back to Isaiah, so I think you're familiar with that. It's all the references to Moses getting the law. Now it says in 22, though, you're not doing that anymore. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, which is already mentioned as relates to the sprinkling of the blood in chapter 9, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood, which speaks better than that of Abel, the blood of Abel. So again, we have this mountaintop of accomplishment and power that you could not have ever before. So the Old Testament had a lot of good stuff in it, served its purpose, served it well. Lasted 1,500 years, but we've had 2,000 years of an eternal church. We've had 2,000 years of actual cleansing. Not another drop of an animal's blood needed to be shed, because in the blood of Jesus, which is now sprinkled upon hearts and minds and souls and spirits and consciences, in the spirit world, there is true, real, lasting, complete cleansing, atonement, redemption, forgiveness. So I hope you can appreciate, particularly in Hebrews here, that what Isaiah is talking about, as they would read it 700 years before Christ, what would they do? The same thing who did in Acts 8. Happened in Acts 8. Who gets converted in Acts 8?
The eunuch.
The eunuch gets converted. What's the eunuch reading in Acts 8? 53. What's he doing in his chariot? He's going. Up comes running Philip. You know what you're reading? How could I? So Philip starts right there. But what was the eunuch's question that Philip answered? Of whom does the prophet speak? Of himself or someone else? He's speaking of someone else. So, starting in 13, 14, and 15, we're going to find out about that someone else. We're going to find out about that servant. And 700 years later, the eunuch is not going to have to scratch any more hair off this side of his head. Phil's going to tell him. It's Jesus. Just like the Hebrew letter tells us. It's Jesus. That's who we're talking about. Now one last thing and then we'll go back to the book itself. 1 Peter begins with this thought. So if you're in Hebrews, you just need to turn a couple more pages. James, of course, is right there. And then comes 1 Peter. Here's how Peter, you know, the speaker in Acts 2, begins his letter. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, that you may obey Jesus Christ and be what? Sprinkled with His blood. May grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure. So, brother, we likely don't do as good a job as we might, but if you're going to spend really some serious time working with somebody and just tell them everything there is to know about baptism, then the picture they ought to have, if they've really studied this out for like 16 weeks, is that as you lower them backwards and that water closes over their eyes, what's happening? 1 Peter, what's happening? The blood of Jesus is being sprinkled upon them, and their bodies are washed with pure water. And with the sprinkling of that blood in that moment, then what? What about sin? Goats do it? Bulls? No. What happens under that water? Cleansing. And you come back up again, what's your conscience thinking? Guilty or innocent? Forgiven. I was guilty, but now forgiven. And so, 1 Peter, is the one passage, really, that makes this so personal and so direct. And as he opens up his verse, Peter's, the first two verses, it's like he gathers up the whole Old Testament, and then baptizes you, and you have this sprinkling of Christ's blood and cleansing, forgiveness, clean conscience. This really, brethren, is the mountain peak of Isaiah chapter 53. It brought us to this. Well, is that glorious? Is that beautiful? Is that attractive? See? Towering above the valley of the shadow of death is Jesus and His eternal success. But what did He have to go through to give us that clean conscience? He had to go through that. I sat looking at that picture. I hadn't found it ever before. Today, and I thought, maybe I'll use that for the Lord's Supper. And I thought, it's just too gruesome. You just can't even do it. Okay? You want to look away. And that does not begin to tell the story. His marred flesh is not even in the picture. We can't imagine. We can't imagine, brethren, what Isaiah 53 is trying to tell us 7 centuries before its fulfillment in this manner. Isaiah 52:13. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, so his appearance was marred more than any man, in his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what had not been told them, they will see. What they had not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows, and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but Yahweh
has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. But Yahweh was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, if he would render himself as a guilt offering. He will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. And the good pleasure of Yahweh will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sins of many and interceded for the transgressors. Shout for joy, O barren one! Okay? Brethren, in the sweep of Isaiah 53 and 54, we come from the valley of the shadow of death to the top of the mountain, don't we? We get to see it all, the fulfillment of the entire Old Testament. We can hear the angels sing, brethren, myriads of them in Hebrews 12. It's so much better what we have. But 7 centuries before that, and clear up to a eunuch in a chariot on his way to Gaza, they had to just wonder, what is that about? Is that Isaiah? Is that somebody else? No. That is Jesus. So, Galatians 4, of course, is quoted in the first part of chapter 54, but it's turning to the shout for joy. We'll save that likely now with less than 20 minutes to go, you know, for next week. But let's do go back now and look at 53. Any comment or question, observation before we actually go verse by verse now? Okay. 53:1. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Well, he's saying this is difficult. It's not easily understood. Hardly anybody, well, nobody understands it. You know, who? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of parched ground. No former majesty that we should look upon him, or appearance that we should be attracted to him. Despised, forsaken of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, like one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we didn't esteem him. He's just no count, nobody, this servant. Nothing special. No high and noble parentage, no great wealth, no nothing to commend him. Just a guy. This guy, you and I know, is the Son of the Living God. You know, tender shoot and root out of parched ground. You know, where has he grown up? Palestine. You know, this isn't Rome. This isn't Alexandria. This isn't Antioch of Syria. You know, just can any good thing even come out of Nazareth? Just Jesus through and through. And then he himself, verse 4, our griefs he bore, our sorrows he carried. We ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Now, bear in mind, brethren, 3 days he's in the grave. What are the apostles thinking? What do they say on the road to Emmaus? So we thought he was the one. See? But now we're disappointed. Now we've learned different, and it really hurts. You know, we're disappointed. We were wrong. Okay, well, who understood the first verses of 53? Not even the apostles, not even the saints, not even the disciples, you know, at the beginning. But in verse 5, He was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him. By his scourging, we are healed. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us turned to his own way. The Lord caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. It was all about us, and we didn't get it. Well, it's being prophesied 700 years in advance, but when you look at the Gospels, what do you see? Brethren, every line in Isaiah 53 is found in the New Testament, either in direct quotes, which we're about to come to, or in allusions, references, you know, that are unmistakable. Here's the quote in verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? Where is it quoted? Acts chapter 8. This is what the eunuch was reading. Now you have to be careful, and I drew one of my parenthetical deals, you know, a circle or whatever you want to do. The quote in Acts 8, verses 32 and 33, so if you want to make the reference, it's Acts 8, 32 and 33, does not include the first line in our verse 7. It doesn't start with he was oppressed and he was afflicted. It starts with he didn't open his mouth. Okay, and then it ends in Acts 8, 33, just before the last line in verse 8. In Acts, it does not say, for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due. So when it's quoted, he did not open his mouth like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? And the eunuch says, who is that? Philip starts there and preaches what? Jesus. If you're going to preach Jesus and you got an open heart, what's the next thing that'll come spilling out of that person's face? Look, here's water. What permits me? And the answer is absolutely nothing. Do you believe this? You're good to go. Okay? So in 9, his grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor is there any deceit in his mouth. Now, in the first half of verse 9, you don't have it quoted in the New Testament, but what do you have? Whose tomb was Jesus buried in, rich or poor? Rich. So, they counted him wicked, they gave him the worst kind of death, he had a robber on each side of him. But then, did the robbers get buried in rich men's tombs? No, but he did. My servant did. And then, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Just the line at the end of verse 9, nor was there any deceit in his mouth, if you want to make the note, is quoted in 1 Peter. But this time in chapter 2, verse 22. So, 1 Peter shows up again when we're thinking about sprinkling at the very start of the epistle. When he gets to chapter 2, 22, he's quoting out of Isaiah 53. Verse 10. The Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, if, and note the volition that's involved, if he would render himself. His will chose to do this. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. Now that's already reminiscent of 52 verse 13. My servant will prosper. He'll be high and lifted up. Okay, we've got a circle that's about to be completed. And then the last thing in verse 10 is it. The good pleasure of the Lord will what in his hand? Prosper. How does 52:13 begin? My servant will prosper. So clearly 13, 14, and 15 belong in this section. It's not complete without them. If you start reading at 53:1, you're missing, you know, an introduction that has a related conclusion. later in 53. So there's 10, now 11. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, for he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great. He will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors.
So, brethren, throughout the last three verses of 52, and then, of course, with 53, chapter 53, you just go up and down the mountain, don't you? It's just the most amazing chapter. From the shadow of death, and unmarred features, and despised, man of sorrows and grief, and all of it falling on him, and by his wounds, you know, we are healed. You know, but then it's prosperity and high exaltation and children, you know, that will come because the many nations are sprinkled. And so it's a kingdom without end. It's a kingdom that's endured now for 500 years longer than the old law was being practiced. It is the reality where the Old Testament was just a shadow. Just the shadow. All right, let's roll on into chapter 54. I've got 10 minutes. Shout for joy, O barren one, you who have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting and cry aloud, you who have not travailed. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says the Lord. Now, make the note, make it prominent, very important that you get the note. That first verse is developed at length in Galatians 4, verses 21 through 27. Galatians 4, 21 through 27. So I'll tell you what, let's do this. I was going to try to get further in to Isaiah 54, but I think better of it now. Let's go ahead and look at Galatians. We'll close out in that manner, and then we'll just start with chapter 54 next week. So, Jerry, we'll call it, you know, 52:13 through 53:12 if you want, and or just call it Isaiah 53, and that'll work for me too. But let's go back to Galatians 4, 21 through 27, everybody, and we'll wrap it up there for tonight. 4:21 of Galatians. Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to the law? For it was written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman and one by the free woman. But the son of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son of the free woman through the promise. This is allegorically speaking. For these women are two covenants. One from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds, this is really important when we start getting into Revelation, isn't it? Corresponds to the present Jerusalem. Revelation has a lot to say about a new one that comes down out of heaven, a heavenly Jerusalem. But Hagar, Mount Sinai, Arabia, corresponds to the present Jerusalem of Galatians, maybe 48 or 49 A.D. That's the Jerusalem that you saw a lot on the news today. Okay, all over the news. Saw pictures of Jerusalem today. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So then, she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother. Jerusalem above is a heavenly Jerusalem, a new Jerusalem. A Jerusalem comes down out of heaven to be here on the earth. Jerusalem above is free, and she's our mother. For it's written, rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for more are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. So here you have perhaps the most dramatic and best explained presentation of what an Old Testament type and a New Testament antitype is. Of what a shadow does and how the substance, you know, is the reality of it. And so here we've just got the verses we read at the start of Isaiah 54. But finally, after 700 years, Paul tells them what he's talking about. The women were covenants back in Genesis. And now shout in Isaiah, 1,200 years after Abraham. Shout in Isaiah. You know why? There'll be a whole lot of children. Kings will have their mouths stopped. Gentiles will be sprinkled with the blood. You know, there's way more Christians through these 2,000 years, brethren, than there ever were Jews. Okay? And so, more of the children of the free woman. And our mother is which Jerusalem? The one that's down here, or the one that's what? The one that's up there, and in Revelation, does not stay up there, and does not represent heaven. It's the Jerusalem in Revelation that comes down out of heaven. Okay, it came down to be here. It's the church in Revelation. And it's the church here. It's a new covenant. It's a new Jerusalem. It's a spiritual Jerusalem. And you read about it in Hebrews 12 when we saw the last of the Hebrew passages about the sprinkling. Amen?